Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Dean Reuter. I'm director of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. Thank you all for being here today. Very much appreciate you attending our event on gay marriage and the role of the judiciary. Before we begin, let me make a brief commercial announcement for our National Lawyers Convention, which will take place in this same venue in just a few weeks, November 20th through the 22nd. Probably many of you have been here before for that event. I encourage you to check it out online and register if you're able to attend. It's a great way to get all your CLE done for the entire year in one short weekend. So, turning to today's program, my only responsibility here today is to introduce Stuart Taylor, our moderator. Stuart writes for the National Journal and for Newsweek. He's probably familiar to many of you, and if you're familiar with his work, you know why we asked him to moderate, because he always writes intelligently and always has something interesting to say or to ask. And if you are not familiar with his work, I encourage you to check it out. So without further, Stuart.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you all for coming. You know our topic. At the risk of belaboring the obvious, we'll be talking both about whether same-sex marriage is good policy and about whether it should be imposed by judicial decree as a constitutional right. Your moderator, your faithful moderator's position is yes as to the first question and no as to the second, which, depending on your point of view, might mean that I'm either exquisitely even-handed or biased against both sides. I leave the panelists to decide which of those they want to talk about. I'm going to introduce our panelists, very distinguished panelists, in the order in which they'll appear, and I'll only read little snatches of their very distinguished biography. First up will be Lara Schwartz, legal director and chief legislative counsel of the Human Rights Campaign, which she joined in 2002. Lara advocates against anti-gay marriage, double negative constitutional amendments such as the Federal Marriage Amendment. She promotes legislation on tax benefits and other issues that affect the everyday lives of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people and their families, as well as legislation to prevent bias-motivated violence. She works on judicial nominations, judicial independence, has been at two law firms, Gilbert Heinz Randolph and Skadden Arps, and was a law clerk to the Honorable Ronald E. Gilman on the Sixth Circuit. Lara is a graduate of Harvard Law School and Brown University. Second will be Charles J. Chuck Cooper to his friends. Chuck is a founding member of the D.C. law firm of Cooper and Kirk. He was named by National Law Journal as one of the 10 best civil litigators in Washington, has over 30 years' experience in government and private practice with several appearances before the Supreme Court, scores of other successful cases on both trial and appellate levels. Chuck was a law clerk to Judge Paul Roney of the Fifth Circuit, now 11th, and to later Chief Justice William Rehnquist, has worked in several Justice Department positions, as well as his distinguished private practice career. Next will be Jamie Raskin, to my left, who's a professor of constitutional law and First Amendment at American University's Washington College of Law. He's also the Democratic State Senator representing Silver Spring and Tacoma Park in Annapolis. In his first bid for public office, Jamie was elected in November of 2006 with 67% of the vote in the primary, and the Saddam Hussein topping 99% of the vote in the general election. I hope you'll have time to tell us how you did that.
Well, it's easier when you have no opponent.
The Washington Post has described Jamie as the Senate's authority on constitutional issues, and the Silver Spring Voice recently called him the whiz kid of the General Assembly. And he has many other great encomiums. He's a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, where he was an editor of the Harvard Law Review. And our last panelist, Maggie Gallagher, is president of the National Organization for Marriage, whose mission is protecting, quote, protecting marriage and the faith communities that sustain it, end quote. NOM was formed with Princeton professor Robbie George in July of 2007. Its biggest achievement to date is raising more than $1 million this spring to get Proposition 8 on the ballot in California in time to respond to the California Supreme Court's decision, which we'll be talking about today, released this May impose same-sex marriage. Maggie is a nationally syndicated columnist, the author of three books on marriage, including most recently with University of Chicago Professor Linda Waite, The Case for Marriage, Why Married People Are Happier, Healthier, and Better Off Financially. She's also a contributor to the National Review, National Review Online, I guess. Maggie is a graduate of Yale. She lives with her husband and two children in Westchester, New York. And with that, I turn the podium to, or she prefers to sit, the panelists are free to do either, to Lara Schwartz.
I think I'll stay seated, partly because it's amusing that all the panelists are to my left, which with the exception of Jamie seems really unlikely. people ask me over at the office what I thought it would be like going over to talk to an audience that was unlikely to overwhelmingly share my views, and I said, you know, it's always good to be with folks who you can have an interchange with, and I see you guys have actually seen fit to provide me with some French water, so I am at home. That was loud. So, on the two issues, I think that it's a great idea that you've chosen to craft this panel at being both about the law and policy, which I know is in the title of your esteemed organization, because you know, the law and the policy go hand in hand. I am actually not a person who believes, and more importantly, not a lawyer who believes, that courts should craft public policy. Public policy is to be crafted, you know, it starts out among people who think and do and believe and write interesting articles, as many of the people in this room do, and it percolates to the people who make laws like Jamie does, and that's where public policy comes from. So that's not what courts do. What courts do is apply law to fact. And that's what I think is the aspect of this conversation that I'd like to touch on, which is fact. It's easy, especially for those of us who are lawyers, to immediately dive into our thoughts of what constitutions, and I say constitutions because we have California, Massachusetts, Connecticut, what constitutions mean at the moment that, you know, one of these opinions comes hot off the presses, and then we can have these really interesting animated discussions about, you know, originalism or activism or living constitution or snoozing constitution or whatever it is. But the thing that is important to know is that even embedded into the fairly well-established and I think universally agreed upon tests that we use in testing the constitutionality of a provision, you know, the rational basis, intermediate scrutiny, strict scrutiny, embedded in those is the intertwining of the law, the Constitution, and the facts on the ground. Now, what I see is the sea change between before gay and lesbian couples started winning these cases and once they started winning these cases, is not a new and novel approach to a constitution, nor kind of an emboldened step by these judges who think, you know, public opinion's just close enough that we can pull this one off on people. I see it as a combination of a change of certain facts on the ground and increased understanding of other facts on the ground that have always been there. So first, the change of facts on the ground. California and Massachusetts and Connecticut, excuse me, both at the time that their Supreme Courts decided their cases, one in May, one just recently, already had civil union or domestic partnership laws that provided benefits and protections to families headed by gay and lesbian couples at the maximum extent that the state could provide. They already provided second parent adoption or step parent adoption for the non-biological or original non-adoptive parents of children being raised by these couples. They already had divorce laws that said that whether we favor children having a mother and father or not, mothers and fathers can leave that arrangement. And they'd had those obviously for longer than their domestic partner laws. And they already had, and Connecticut's pretty famous for this with the Griswold case, they had an entrenched sense of people's being able to regulate their own reproductive capacities, trumping state interests in deciding how those reproductive capacities are used. So all of these are facts on the ground at the time that these cases were decided. Now, another fact on the ground as these cases were decided, and I know that, you know, my esteemed co-panelists over here will have different things to say, but essentially every social science and medical organization in this country that is founded on a non-ideological basis, but rather a scientific or medical basis, has concluded that gay and lesbian people are gay and lesbian because they're born that way. And that gay and lesbian families and all of the child social services have come to this conclusion as well in the research of same-sex couples raising children, is that gay and lesbian parents and gay and lesbian couples are equally able parents. Now, this is something that we've come to know. In a sense, it doesn't really matter whether you're one of the people who says, no, I can find someone in Scandinavia who said that's not true. Because when you get back to applying law to facts, and we don't even need intermediate scrutiny, we can just stick with rational basis. When you come back to applying law to facts, what you get is you need a legitimate state interest and one that's rationally related to the ban on marriage. Now, preserving the idea of marriage and regulating procreation, which is what the dissenters in Connecticut said, regulating the way that procreation takes place within certain contexts, are the two, sort of the last two ideas standing at the end of the day when you kind of knock out everything else along the way. And these are the two that defenders of the bans have continued to bank on at this point. So taking the regulation of procreation, when the facts on the ground are that a state has willingly said, we do not regulate procreation, we don't think it's necessarily in our interest to limit procreation or the rearing of children to different sex couples. In fact, we privilege and foster and provide benefits to same-sex couples who are rearing children and treat those children as we would the children of married couples and provide the same incentives and protections and benefits that we would otherwise. That kind of falls away, because while you might possibly argue that the protection, the regulation of procreation in that regard is sufficiently legitimate to at least pass rational basis, you don't get, you can't get to the fact that it is considered even by the state to be a legitimate state interest anymore, because they're not pursuing it at the point that they have a civil union or domestic partnership law. And that's dangerous to my side to say out loud, but I'll get to that in a second. So then you get to the preserve the original definition of marriage. And people on my side, and you know, a lot of thoughtful people on all sides will acknowledge, well, marriage might originally have been a man purchasing a variety of women from their parents, and you know, that's changed. It might have been a permanent partnership, not breakable by divorce, that's changed. There's a whole lot of things about marriage that have changed. But even if you take as gospel, and for some people that's exactly right, that is gospel, even if you take as gospel that the change from different sex to same sex is just so fundamentally different, and it's just different in kind and magnitude from any of these other changes, polygamy to monogamy, ownership to equality, gendered roles to non-gendered roles. Even if you take that, the problem is that you have a problem once you've acknowledged that gay people exist as gay people, are born as gay people, live as gay people, exist as a group, the idea of preservation really amounts to a symbolic difference. We must symbolically hold out one status for the people who are somehow either better or to be emulated. We have to hold out marriage as something we can tell our kids you aspire to and reserve these other statuses just in case they end up gay anyway and we really don't want to hurt them. And that kind of distinction between two groups of people is constitutionally suspect. But what I would argue is that it doesn't require a fresh look at whether the Constitution is living or dead. It doesn't require, or static, it doesn't require a fresh look at whether there's a new right we never thought of before, gay marriage. It only requires looking at the facts on the ground and saying gay people are. And if gay people are, then the step toward gay people are equal is kind of a no-brainer. Now, to close, I will just say that what I've said is kind of dangerous to the goals that I, my organization, the community I represent have, because what I've basically said is something that you'll hear from people somewhat less progressive than myself, that we can have these civil unions, we can have these domestic partnerships. Sarah Palin said it, you know, they lead to marriage. Nobody wants marriage in that particular group, so how can you have domestic partnerships? I've just doomed them because this room will decide everything forever. By saying, look, once you have them, you've killed your argument that you can ban marriage. And, you know, that in a way is problematic for my side, but it's been said aloud by two courts with a lot more authority than myself. And it does make sense when you acknowledge that it is not the public policy of a state to treat the children of same-sex couples differently than the children of married different-sex couples. You know, this is where you arrive. And, you know, unfortunately, I'd love to be on the cutting edge of new legal theories, but at the end of the day, once you acknowledge the facts, this is all very boring, which is why I wore pinstripes. So with that.
Chuck, do you have anything to say to that?
The podium here, and I plan to focus my thoughts on the role of the courts part of this debate, and to focus on the California marriage case, and then focus even more finally on just a couple of observations about it. We don't have time to really get into all the things I think critiques that would be warranted, but Senator Obama opposes same-sex marriage, and he recently had this to say about the issue. I believe that civil unions of same-sex couples should include the same legal rights that accompany a marriage license. However, I do not support gay marriage. Marriage has religious and social connotations, and I consider marriage to be between a man and a woman. Senator Biden said much the same thing in his debate with Governor Palin, as I'm sure most of you will recall. Well, the people and the legislature of the state of California and Connecticut agree with Senators Obama and Biden. And in recent years, they've enacted laws that both, one, granted same-sex couples the right to enter into domestic partnerships, which effectively extend, as you just heard, all the rights and responsibilities of marriage to same-sex couples, and two, also reaffirmed the common law age-old definition of marriage as the union of one man and one woman, and in California reaffirmed it as recently as 2000 in a referendum by the people themselves. As the California Court of Appeal, when the case was at that level, observed, by maintaining the traditional definition of marriage, while simultaneously granting legal recognition and expanded rights to same-sex relationships, the legislature has struck a careful balance to satisfy the diverse needs and desires of Californians. Well, it turns out that balance, favored by the people of California, as well as Senators Obama and Biden, is unconstitutional, according to a 4-3 majority of the California Supreme Court, which held that under the California Constitution, that balance violates the privacy and liberty interests of gays and lesbians. The problem with the Domestic Partnership Act is that although the state had extended virtually all of the rights, benefits, and responsibilities of marriage to same-sex couples, it did not also extend the label marriage to their unions, but rather called them domestic partnerships. The majority held that the state not only must accord same-sex couples all the rights and benefits of marriage, it must call their union marriage as well. Now, that four-justice majority explained that in decreeing same-sex marriage, it was merely acting as the obedient servant of the people's will, as they put it, enforcing, again, quoting the court, restraints that the people themselves impose upon themselves when they establish that the California Constitution that in the California Constitution, the fundamental right of a man to marry another man and a woman to marry another woman. Now, you can imagine the surprise that many Californians, at least, had when they realized that they had done that. I can see them reading this opinion now. Geez, did we do that? I don't remember doing that. Do you remember doing when we did that? The majority arrived at this implausible result by simply defining the fundamental right to marry, which all agreed in that case, and I think most people agree more broadly, is a protected liberty interest, that the fundamental right to marry was defined not as the right to enter a union between a man and a woman, but rather as, in its words, the right of an individual to establish a legally recognized family with the person of one's choice, including a person of the same sex. Now, the majority was frank to acknowledge the following inconvenient truths: that the institution of civil marriage in California law, both code and case law, has always been understood to refer to the traditional common law definition of one man and one woman; that California's first constitution in 1849 specifically spoke of marriage in terms of husbands and wives; that in quoting now the majority, the institution of marriage originated in large part to promote a stable relationship for the procreation and raising of children; and finally, that there has been a widespread historic societal disapproval of homosexuality. Now, the California Court of Appeals, when the case was there, had concluded from this same history that the California Constitution defines and protects only a fundamental right to marry a person of the opposite sex. There was no evidence that the right to marry included a person of the same sex. But when the case got to the California Supreme Court, the majority rejected the age-old definition of the institution of marriage simply because defining it so narrowly would withhold the protections afforded by the right to marry from gays and lesbians. That's what the majority said. If we define it narrowly in this fashion, it won't embrace gays and lesbians. So that's how we'll define it. So the majority simply redefined the right to marry as one, in its words, guaranteed to all individuals and couples without regard to their sexual orientation. Now, from there, it was just a short step for the majority to conclude that the state could not withhold the label marriage from same-sex unions. Same-sex couples are entitled, the majority said, to have their official family relationship accorded the same dignity, respect, and stature as that accorded to all other officially recognized family relationships. And once you've acknowledged or redefined the right to marry to include same-sex unions, that seems like certainly a reasonable element of that. But nowhere in the majority's lengthy opinion does it attempt to explain how its rulings relate to the people's will, how it can plausibly be said that the people themselves have truly established the right to marry that the majority is enforcing. And in this regard, it is instructive, I think, to retrace the path that brings the majority's ruling to the people of California. Many of you will recall that in Bowers against Hardwick, the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, upheld laws criminalizing private, consensual, homosexual sodomy. There was no fundamental right implicated, the court held, and the public's moral and social disapproval of sodomy was an acceptable, rational basis for the law. In Lawrence against Texas, of course, the Supreme Court overruled Bowers. it found, again, still, that there's no fundamental right here at stake, but the court concluded that the public's moral values no longer provided a legitimate justification for the anti-sodomy law's intrusion into the personal and private sexual conduct of the individual. Now, Lawrence was and remains a very controversial case, but even those who cheer it surely must agree with this. It is one thing to say, as the Lawrence majority did, that an individual's privacy and liberty interests in his or her sexual preferences and practices trump anti-sodomy laws reflecting the public's moral and social disapproval of those preferences and practices. But it is quite another thing to say, as the California Supreme Court majority has said, that an individual's liberty and privacy interests entitle him to insist that the public and society affirmatively accept his sexual preferences and practices and grant them affirmative moral and social approval and official legal sanction, even to the point of redefining the age-old definition of marriage to include same-sex unions, imbued no less with the same dignity and stature as traditional opposite-sex marriages. On reading the California majority opinion, one can almost hear the faint echo of Robespierre. If Frenchmen will not be virtuous, then I will cram virtue down their throats. When and how did the people of California surrender to the judiciary their sovereign legislative authority to decide for themselves this social policy issue, an issue that is inherently rife with moral judgments? Well, it wasn't, I submit to you, when the people of California protected fundamental liberty interests in the California Constitution. No, the people of California surrendered their sovereign legislative power on this issue the moment they swore these four justices into office.
Is up next.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here with my fellow panelists. Laura Schwartz was actually a constituent of mine until she stabbed me in the back a few months ago and moved into the District of Columbia, where her vote is not needed for anything. And it's nice to meet Maggie. And, of course, my pal Chuck Cooper, who's my favorite person to debate in the world. And whenever I feel tempted to get real polemical and mean in one of these things, I think about Chuck because he's such a reasonable guy, and I just can never understand whether he really means the things he's saying or not. And I say I'm gonna try to state this in such a way that Chuck hopefully will really listen to me, and we can have a meaningful discussion. And so, anyway, thank you for making me part of this, and thanks to Stuart Taylor, who has shared his time with us. He has a golden pen and a caustic wit. I love to read what he's got to write. And all of you, thanks for taking time from your busy days to be here, and the Federalist Society itself, which, needless to say, I'm not a member of, but you've doubtly had a major influence on all of the successes of the Bush administration and its Justice Department over the last 8 years.
Yeah.
So let's see. Well, the first thing is I did want to inject a little levity in this situation because I know two good lines related to the issue. One comes from Kinky Friedman, who was a candidate for, I think, governor in Texas, who said, gay marriage? Of course I'm for gay marriage. I think gay people have every right to be as miserable as everybody else. The other came from a colleague of mine who will remain unnamed, but he said, well, you know, really if you want to convince the Republicans on this issue, you should just tell them that if you're opposed to gay sex, you should support gay marriage because everybody knows there's no sex after marriage. And this is the way to get rid of it. Okay. So the first thing is I do want to correct the title, because in some sense the title itself betrays the whole division here, because the first words are gay marriage, but there's no such thing as gay marriage. We're not talking about gay marriage. We're just talking about marriage and whether the institution should be open to everybody who lives in a particular state, everybody who lives in the society. When the California Supreme Court in 1948 in Perez versus Sharp struck down the ban on interracial marriage in California, the ban on miscegenation, it did not create a new institution called interracial marriage. It just said marriage, with all of its rights and benefits in California, is open to everybody, regardless of who it is that you choose to marry. And then the Supreme Court, several decades later, followed along in 1967 with Loving versus Virginia, where it said under the Equal Protection Clause, Virginia and other states which continued to ban interracial marriage could not do so because it was a fundamental interference with the right of people to marry who they want to marry. So we're not talking about gay marriage, we're just talking about marriage for everyone. Now, in the spirit of trying to bring Chuck along, I want to try to start with what we may agree upon and then see at what point we part ways, and so we can really isolate our differences. The first thing is we can agree, presumably, that marriage is a central social institution that provides not only extraordinary personal, emotional, and financial security and benefits to people, but also a superabundance of concrete legal, social, and economic benefits and rights and obligations that are provided by the state. And so I flipped through my statute book, and here are a few that come in, and I actually did this more systematically when we debated this issue in the last legislative session, but joint filing, tenancy by the entirety, homestead protection, property inheritance, the right to share medical insurance policies, medical decision-making and visits, financial protection, Social Security survivorship benefits, equitable division of marital property upon divorce, right to bring claims for wrongful death and loss of consortium, as well as funeral and burial expenses and wrongful death actions, and so on. And again, in Maryland, there are more than 500 benefits, and at the federal level, again, hundreds of benefits that are attendant to people having married status. And so this is a bread and butter issue for lots of my constituents. I have thousands of gay and lesbian constituents, many of whom are in very long-term relationships, many of whom have children, many of whom feel vulnerable and defenseless and are constantly trying to piece together the legal protections and rights and entitlements that those of us who are married get as a matter of law. Now, we also agree, presumably, that marriage is a fundamental right. I think I did hear Chuck say that within the meaning of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process liberty clauses, such that it cannot be denied to citizens without demonstrating a compelling state interest, and that the denial of the right to marry is necessary to vindicate a compelling state interest. And this is an interest that's so strong and so overwhelming that the Supreme Court has found that it applies to deadbeat dads. That's Zablocki versus Redhill. You can't keep a guy from marrying even if he's way behind and in arrears on his child support payments to a prior wife. It applies even to convicted felons, and in fact it applies even to prisoners on death row, as long as they're willing to marry the person of the right gender, which usually means a woman. And strangely, death row convicts seem to have a very good record of finding people to marry them for some reason. All of that is constitutionally protected. The state cannot take it away. Say, you know, just because you're a mass murderer and a rapist, we're going to deny you the right to marry. No, the court has said it's such a fundamental right that we can't take it away even from you. Now, the court, as Chuck reminds us, in Lawrence versus Texas in 1992, struck down criminal sodomy laws, is not having any rational basis at all. It overturned the prior result in Bowers versus Hardwick, where Chief Justice Berger had said, for us to find that there's a right to sodomy would require us to discard millennia of moral teaching. And that's precisely what the majority in Lawrence versus Texas did. It said, we are going to discard millennia of moral teaching, because guess what? We're not the moral tutors of the country. It's not to us, the court said, to impose a moral code on society. It's to interpret the constitutional text and define the liberty of all. Specifically, Our obligation, the majority said, is to define the liberty of all citizens, not to mandate our own moral code. And the court found that there was simply no rational basis for allowing the state to forbid to gay people the same sexual acts that straight people are allowed to engage in. And I don't mean to scandalize anybody here at the Federalist Society, but there are no sexual acts that gay people engage in that straight people don't engage in. And the Supreme Court said, therefore, this is just discrimination. Now, Texas tried to mobilize a whole host of interests to say, we've got interests, but all of them came back to the majority disapproves of these acts when you do them. When two men do them or two women do them, not when a man and woman do them, but when you do them, we disapprove. And the majority in the court, Justice Kennedy, says that is not a sufficiently rational basis for effectuating law, because after all, that was the exact same interest that the court overthrew in Loving versus Virginia. Of course the majority of the people in Virginia said that a black person shouldn't be able to marry a white person. A white person shouldn't be able to marry an Hispanic person. Lots of states said that, but that's irrelevant, the court said. The majority's animus towards a particular group cannot be a sufficient basis to sustain a law against attack under the Due Process Clause or under the Equal Protection Clause. It fails even rational basis scrutiny, the lowest level of scrutiny that we got. Now, we also agree, presumably, that state courts are perfectly within their rights and powers to find more expansive protections for civil liberty than are found in the U.S. Constitution. As the Supreme Court put it in 1995 in Arizona versus Evans, state courts are absolutely free to interpret state constitutions to accord greater protection to individual rights than do similar provisions in the U.S. Constitution. And I'm sure a brilliant lawyer like Mr. Cooper, when representing business clients, knows at the state level that, well, maybe if he doesn't have it at the federal level, he can allege that there's a violation, say, of due process economic liberty at the state level. And that is part of constitutional federalism. In fact, it was very much the design of the Federalists to say that the state Supreme Courts should be the primary guarantors and champions of the civil liberty of the people. Now, I hope at least we've agreed up until this point. I hope we can also agree on this. When the Supreme Courts of Massachusetts and California and Connecticut established the right of all citizens, including gays and lesbians, to marry, they were not inventing a new right. They were taking an existing bundle of rights, responsibilities, and privileges and said that they had to be open to all citizens. And although the constitutions of each state are different, and the reasoning of each court in these cases differs in general, the state constitutions have both, all of them have both liberty and equality protections. And it's under those provisions that the court has said, that the courts have said that the ban on gays marrying is unconstitutional. Now, the three courts that did it actually got there along different paths. Because the language is different and the reasoning of the courts is different. Some used strict scrutiny, and some, like the Massachusetts court said, as the Supreme Court did in Lawrence versus Texas, there's simply no rational basis for excluding gay people from the institution. And this becomes a really important part in our legislative debates, because the rhetoric on the other side, which we always heard, is we're trying to defend marriage. We're trying to save marriage. We're trying to rescue marriage. But let's just stop and think about that for a second. If my neighbors, Steve and Al, who've been together for more than 30 years and are taking care of Steve's mom, who's in her 90s, and they've been together all this time. If they actually didn't just get to live together, but to be married and have the same rights that my wife Sarah and I have, how does it in any way undermine my marriage? Can anyone explain how it threatens any heterosexual marriage in the state of Maryland or Virginia or the District of Columbia or anywhere to allow our gay and lesbian fellow citizens to marry? I just don't get it. I know it bothers some people. I know that it offends some people's religious beliefs. But surely in a country that's built on the premise of the separation of church and state, no establishment of religion, no religious test for public office, freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, we can't allow some people to impose a religious test on how other people lead their lives and whether they'll get the equal distribution of rights and benefits from the state. Now, so if there is a valid, rational interest in denying citizens this right, I would like to know what it is. Finally, I want to make a point about judicial activism, which I think we know by now is really always in the eye of the beholder. It's an epithet. And no less a conservative than Judge Easterbrook has said it's time to retire the whole phrase because basically we use judicial activism to describe a decision we disagree with. If it means what most people think it means, and I think this is what Chuck Cooper was implying, if it means striking down laws passed by popular and legislative majorities, and he had a nice rhetorical twist at the end about Robespierre, well, then, of course, the Rehnquist Court absolutely takes the cake in American history. It has struck down more federal and state laws than any other court in history. And I'll just give you a few examples to refresh the mind. Well, of course, there's Bush versus Gore, which is the masterpiece of judicial activism. Shaw versus Reno and Miller versus Johnson, striking down state legislative redistricting plans. Adirond Constructors and Richmond versus Croson, striking down local federal and state affirmative action plans. The City of Bernie case, striking down the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The Lopez decision, striking down the Gun-Free School Zones Act. The Kimmel case, the Garrett case, striking down age discrimination, remedy provisions against the state, remedy discrimination provisions on, based on disabilities in the Garrett case, and on and on and on. I just find it too convenient and too selective to pick out one decision and say they struck down a law. Horrible. It's the French Revolution all over again. That's what courts do, is courts strike down laws if they violate constitutional boundaries. And I think that goes back to Marbury versus Madison. And unless Chuck is willing to throw Marbury versus Madison under the bus, I think these courts are doing the right thing if what they're trying to do is analyze the meaning of the Constitution to see whether all of the citizens of the state are entitled to all of the protections that are extended to citizens by law. So, okay. My time is up. Judicial activism might mean some other things, and we can talk about it. I would simply say that this is a real crisis within conservatism. I think that those people who are, in fact, legal and judicial conservatives would say, yes, the law's got to apply equally to everybody. And then there are those who are moral and religious conservatives who say, I want to impose a particular moral view on the judiciary, and that's what they should be enforcing. Thanks.
Thank you, Jamie. I'd like to interject that all I was a little bit jarred at first by the Robespierre analogy. It occurred to me that he was around about the same time as Marbury versus Madison, so maybe it makes a lot of sense. Maggie Gallagher.
Thank you. I only have 10 minutes, and there's so much that we could talk about, including this very rich discussion of what judicial activism is, which is perhaps the founding premise of the Federalist Society. What I'm going to try to do is explain to Senator Raskin and others why this marriage debate matters from the point of view of those of us who disagree with him, because I think that's actually the biggest argument on the table. Sometimes it takes a legal form, as in the Massachusetts court, in my view, intellectually unjustifiable assertion that there is no rational basis for marriage. But more often in a political context, as somebody who's been debating this around the country, I really don't know how I became the girl who goes around the country debating gay marriage. I didn't imagine that that's what I do when I grew up. But the most powerful argument is not these arguments, which have their power in the places, but gee, it's really not going to affect anyone besides Adam and Steve, so even if you don't really agree, why should you get all hot and bothered about it, okay? So I'm going to try to explain. But I would like to address the question of what are the facts on the ground that explain why, in the course of 5 short years, 3 state Supreme Courts, Massachusetts, California, and Connecticut this year, found a fundamental constitutional right to gay marriage rooted in slightly different ways, whereas 3 state Supreme Courts, in no less blue, no less liberal, no less concerned about equality for all, found that marriage satisfied the as a union of husband and wife was in fact constitutional, New York, Washington, and the state of Maryland, okay? Because if it's so clear what the constitutional principles are and we're not engaging in constitutional, anything that could be remotely called judicial activism, why are courts coming out all over the map on this one? And why can courts in fairly liberal states still understand a good reason for marriage to why a well-meaning citizen or legislator would want marriage to remain a union of husband and wife? I propose there are 3 big facts on the ground that change. One of them is the civil union question. And if you want a devastating critique of how terrible it is that this California Supreme Court used the civil union statute to strike down the marriage law. I recommend you read Stuart Taylor's column on that California decision to equate the generosity of the citizens in trying to do something for same-sex couples while protecting their marriage laws with Jim Crow, the grinding Jim Crow segregation is just morally and intellectually unjustifiable in my view, and I'll let Stuart Taylor speak for himself, but it's a heck of a column. The second legal fact on the ground that's different is whether the Attorney General charged with defending the marriage law is willing to state the truth that is deeply embedded in American law. The evidence for it is overwhelming, that marriage laws from their existence have had something to do with the idea of what we now call responsible procreation. Where the Attorney Generals have been willing to assert that this is the state interest, the courts have been willing to find marriage laws constitutional. Where you have Jerry Brown defending your marriage laws, the courts do not really have to address it, and they have not. And Massachusetts is an exception, actually, but in Connecticut and California. And I forget what the third one argument. So I'll move on and say, what I wanted to address was this question that I think people, when we disagree, we really do have a question. So I'm going to try to let you into a window of what it looks like on the other side. Okay, why do we care about, why should anyone care about marriage? What will happen? And I agree, absolutely, there isn't going to be marriage and gay marriage. There's going to be one thing called marriage. And this actually is the third fact on the ground. When a court can understand that we cannot merely open marriage to a new class of citizens, we have to change in some fundamental way what it means, not in terms of legal rights and benefits, but the meaning of the word and the idea and the institution to the wider society. Courts have been generally willing to say that task of changing what marriage means in the minds of your fellow citizens is something you have to do. You can't leave it to a, it's not a court's job to change the institution in that way. And this is where I began, as someone for whom marriage for 25 years has been my main issue, high rates of divorce and family fragmentation, so many fatherless children. Marriage is a virtually universal human social institution, okay? It exists in virtually every known human society, and by the way, it looks wildly different in many places from our own marriage tradition, which is deeply rooted in Judeo-Christian ideas. But everywhere, marriage has a certain basic shape and purpose. Okay? It's a public union. It's not just a private and personal one. It's a sexual union. It's not some other kind of union. Between at least one man and one woman, because polygamy is a common human variant, especially among small tribal societies, in which the rights and the responsibilities of the man and the woman towards each other and towards any children their union produces are publicly defined and supported. And they are, it really just isn't left up to all the individuals to work out what this whole strange thing, attraction, falling in love, sex, the making of children with your bodies, the connecting of that child to a mother and father. And you have to ask yourself, I'm not saying that you can't change it because it's always been that way. I think you have to ask yourself, there aren't that many universal human institutions. Why is it that over and over again people come up with something that's recognizably this marriage idea? And if you have a sense to ask the question, why, it's not that hard to find, okay? Marriage as a universal human idea is deeply rooted in three persistent facts about human beings everywhere. The first is the overwhelming majority of us are powerfully attracted to an act that creates new human life. Sex between men and women makes babies. Society needs babies, okay? Reproduction is optional for the individual, but managing the procreative implications of this whole male-female sexual attraction thing is not. Only societies that figure out how to do it survive. The third idea on which marriage is based is that children need a father as well as a mother. And it is, although mothers and fathers are both important for children, it is fatherhood that is most conceptually implicated in marriage for this simple reason. Okay? When a baby is born, there is bound to be a mother somewhere close by, right? Okay? If we want fathers to be there and to be involved with the children and the mothers of their children, biology alone will not take us very far. You need a cultural mechanism for attaching the father to the mother-child bond and for communicating to the next generation in the middle of their erotic and romantic passions that it's really, really important to do at least one of or more of the difficult, effortful things that people attracted to the opposite sex have to do in order to give this great good to their children. So what happens, what happens to this idea of marriage if we have through the courts, if the law declares that people who see that two men in a union or two women in a union are doing exactly the same thing and must be treated and viewed in exactly the same way? Well, to recognize that, you have to recognize there is not one moral idea on the table here. There are two moral ideas, okay? The law, we will come out of this marriage debate with the law endorsing one and rejecting the other because they are mutually contradictory. The law cannot endorse them both. The gay marriage idea, and here I like to pause and say, with as much respect as I can muster for people with whom I profoundly disagree, I'm not trying to caricature it, I'm trying to capture it. The heart of it goes something like this. There is no morally relevant difference between same-sex and opposite-sex couples with respect to marriage, and anyone who disagrees is engaging in bigotry. The marriage idea, as we have historically understood it, is exactly the opposite. It sits there in the law and it points and it says, hey, look, there's something special about unions of husbands and wives that justifies this unique status in law, culture, and society. So as a marriage person, I got into this debate because I started thinking, if the law endorses the gay marriage idea, there is no morally relevant difference. What is it about the marriage idea that has to go? Anything that really is different about opposite sex unions has to become either morally insignificant, not something you're allowed to notice and attach weight to, and or disconnected from whatever the public purpose of marriage is in the public square, including that these are the only kind of unions that can both make new life and connect those children in love to their own mother and father. This, which has been not only in the law, although repeatedly endorsed in the law, but it, not only in our culture, but in virtually every known culture, the great cross-cultural historic purpose of marriage is the idea that has to be repudiated before you can get to considering gay marriages marriages. And by the way, every court who's gotten to gay marriage has specifically repudiated this idea. But it gets worse than that, and this is a group sponsored by the Religious Liberty Practices Group, so I thought I'd spend a few minutes as I thought through. This is only going to affect Adam and Steve, right? It's not going to affect anyone else. We'll give them some benefits. We'll help their families. Nothing else will change. That's the gay marriage argument. At the same time, if you want to cut through that to see what will change, what must change, particularly if we get to this through a court-endorsed route, just take seriously what gay marriage advocates have said, including here at this table. People like you and me, those of you like you and me at least, who think marriage is the union of husband and wife, are like the bigots who oppose interracial marriage, right? Okay? So if you want to know how things are going to change, ask yourself, how do we treat bigots who oppose interracial marriage in this country, right? Now here's the good news. We don't throw people in jail, okay? People who say that, you know, ministers are going to be forced at the pulpit to marry same-sex couples or engaging in are scared of the wrong thing, let me put it that way. But the law does powerfully intervene to marginalize, stigmatize, and repress an idea which the government has defined as fundamentally counter to basic democratic norms of equality. Okay? This is a subset of the larger truth. Equality arguments don't lead to live and let live. Okay? They do not lead to an expansion of personal liberty. They lead to the expansion of the government power to protect and defend and impose equality norms on the society and to marginalize and stigmatize and repress people who try to promote inequality. That's the function of an equality argument, not only in our constitutional but in our democratic regime. So how do we do this with regard to interracial marriages? Well, licensing is a big issue. Okay, could you oppose interracial marriage and be a licensed physician, attorney, social worker, teacher, marriage counselor, and conduct your practice, in any case, along openly racist lines? Probably not. Could you be a, what about the accreditation process? Could you be a university that espouses openly racist ideas and tries to conduct the university along racist lines? Well, no, and that one was actually litigated along with the companion issue. The single biggest club are things like the tax-exempt status of both the federal and the state tax-exempt status of organizations that do not see two men in a union as just the same as a husband and wife, or in that case, a black and a white as not being really married or ought not to be married in some way. And again, this has been litigated in a famous case called Bob Jones versus the IRS. In 1967, the Supreme Court ruled that state governments could not ban interracial marriages. The government said, just like the California Supreme Court, that that didn't really affect private actors. But it took less than 20 years and no further laws passed and no elected official accountable to the voters. It was an IRS bureaucrat who decided that Bob Jones University, which let both black and white students attend in rather large numbers, actually, it was rather well integrated as Southern universities went, but forbade interracial marriage and dating, could not keep its federal tax exempt status. And there is no First Amendment defense that. The government can, in fact, do this. These are consequences not of some sort of narrow legal minor detail, but of a great big idea that is attempting to be put into the law, which is that that orientation is just like race. The Connecticut court said just like gender, California court said just like race. That equality demands that we see no difference between these kind of unions and treat them no differently. Okay? That idea, and the architects of the gay marriage idea, many of them, are people who really do believe you ought to be treated like a racist if you see any difference between gay and straight, and who do want to use the law to reshape the culture. Not all of them, but a number of them know exactly what they're doing and what they've asked these courts to do and endorse. This will be contested. Okay? There are some religious liberty defenses. The amount of people who agree with you democratically matters and affects how courts. But we're already beginning to see these tussles. If you want to know more about it, there's a great new book, Same-Sex Marriage and Religious Liberty, Emerging Conflicts, edited by Doug Laycock, who's probably one of the great religious liberty scholars in this country. So go look at it. But the point is that once we move to same-sex marriage, these religious liberty impacts will be legally and culturally contested in an environment where the main point, the principle, has already been inserted to the law. There is no difference between same-sex and opposite-sex couples. And if you disagree, you're an irrational bigot. Thank you.
Thanks to all of our panelists. We have, by my count, 18 minutes until 2 o'clock. Here's how I propose to use them. Each panelist, if he or she chooses, can rebut what's been said for 1 or 2 minutes. No more, please. And then I will, if time permits, ask each panelist one question and then open it to the floor. In any event, I'll open it to the floor within about 5 minutes if we haven't gotten to my questions. Lara, any rebuttal?
Yeah, 4 points in 2 minutes. See, like an auctioneer. The California legislature has actually twice passed a marriage equality law. It was vetoed by Governor Schwarzenegger on the grounds that either the courts or the ballot initiative process should decide the matter. Two, on Lawrence. Lawrence case doesn't require jettisoning millennia of morality. Lawrence case requires privatizing millennia of morality, and I think that people in this room would agree that taking ideas, not regulating them, but throwing them into the marketplace of ideas is a good idea, and constitutions regulate state action, not private opinions. On the tax-exempt status, it's been a great argument for drumming up fear, but it's flawed. Abortion is currently a constitutional right. Catholic organizations, I say currently because you never know, Catholic organizations are not denied tax-exempt status. Contraception is a constitutional right. Interracial marriage is a constitutional right. But I grew up in the context of a synagogue that feels like every other Saturday the sermon was about not marrying anyone who wasn't Jewish. Their tax-exempt status is fine. So red herring. And the last point is just I would like to invite you all to Thanksgiving at my house, but A, I'm already borrowing a card table as it is, and B, I'm a vegetarian and I'm making tofurkey, which you don't like. The reason I'd like to is that the three families who are going to be at my Thanksgiving are myself, my fiance, and my 4.5-year-old daughter. This is a triumph of hope over experience in which, in spite of one screw-up, I get to try again, and the state's going to solemnize that and protect it. A couple whose biology heartbreakingly prevented them for five years from conceiving a child, and they were fortunate to find their son, the love of their lives, in Korea and bring him home and both become his legal parents. And a lesbian couple who resides in Virginia who are also fortunate to be bringing their second child into the world. That third family, who have the distinction of A, having had more success biologically in reproducing than one of our families in attendance, and B, have had greater success than myself in getting it right the first time, are the sole family excluded from the institution of marriage. It's irrational.
Thank you. Chuck, do you have any rebuttal?
I only want to make a quick comment about the references to the Perez case in California, the Loving against Virginia case, and the analogy often invoked by the courts and others to the experience in the South and the white supremacist effort primarily in the South and other states to restrict marriage within races, to outlaw interracial marriages. That was a situation where the court did not redefine marriage. It simply applied the fundamental age-old definition of marriage and the right to marry to a restriction on marriage that was an invention, not part of the of the common law and age-old definition of marriage, but rather an invention by white supremacists in order to preserve the notion of white supremacy. The most obvious tell on that was that it only restricted effectively whites from interracial marriage. It allowed non-whites freely to marry outside their race except for with whites. And so that was quite properly subjected to standard suspect classification analysis. If, as the California court went on, and I didn't get into this and for time reasons, but if the California court is correct that sexual orientation is, like race, a suspect classification, then it will be inevitable that the existing definition of marriage will fall. The courts will, and in fact, not just the classification insofar as it relates to marriage, but in every other area. In other words, the California court wasn't content just to rule that opposite-sex marriage violates the California Constitution. It ruled for every case in the future, too, those four justices, by declaring a suspect classification.
Thank you. Jamie, rebuttal?
A bunch of quick points. One, why did three courts suddenly find a fundamental right? Because the gay and lesbian population is demanding equal rights right now. I mean, why did the Supreme Court suddenly find that there were Second Amendment rights in the District of Columbia? Because it was a project, a litigation project, brought by people saying, we want to defend our Second Amendment rights. There's no real mystery there. Why do courts differ about it? I'll up the ante. Why do judges on the same court disagree? Why are most important Supreme Court decisions 5-4? Is it because some are smart and some are stupid? No, it's because there are different methodologies and modes of constitutional interpretation and different values brought to the task. Marriage is different all over the world, but the core of it, Maggie says, is responsible procreation. Well, Canada, South Africa, Belgium, Netherlands, and Spain have all expanded marriage to allow all citizens to get married, including gay and lesbian citizens. Their societies have not collapsed. Western civilization hasn't collapsed. And
it you learned a bet on that?
Maybe that's what's really at fault. I don't know. Well, let's see. So, okay, a few other points. Fertility is not a requirement for marriage. The willingness to procreate is not a requirement for marriage. People can get married in their 60s if both of their partners have died out of love, out of companionship and affection. People who are infertile have a right to marry and live together. In fact, I find there would be something a little bit insulting about the argument that marriage is just for people who procreate and reproduce. And if it's not just for them, if we can open it up to people who aren't going to reproduce, for people who've already reproduced but want to marry again, what's the problem with opening up to other people who I'm sure everybody in this room knows who are gay and lesbian, many of whom actually do have kids and want to have kids? There are straight couples who don't reproduce. They're allowed to get married. There are gay couples who do reproduce. And perhaps they use, you know, fancy new reproductive technologies, but a lot of straight people do too. So, I mean, a part of this is just being grown up enough to recognize the complexity of everybody's lives and everybody's experience. And I would think that that's a conservative value. It's allowing everybody to pursue their own happiness in their own way. The private-public distinction strikes me as very important here for clarifying some of the confusion. You know, my grandmother was adamant that no kids in her family should marry someone who's not Jewish, which a majority of her grandchildren, I think, disobeyed. Okay, she is totally free under current laws to disapprove, to nag, to whine, to say we've done the wrong thing. I actually didn't do the wrong thing, but others have done the wrong thing. There's no problem with that privately. But if she tried to legislate that you can't marry outside of your religious faith, at that point, that's discrimination. And I don't understand, you know, why you say, well, if the law changes, then they're going to make us feel like bigots if we think the law should go back. I mean, there are people who think that the laws against interracial marriage should be restored. People think they're bigots, so what? The people have a First Amendment right to think they're bigots. They have a right to say, I'm not a bigot. So that's all within the First Amendment. The question here is one of state action. That is, what can the government permissibly do and not do? And our point is the government cannot discriminate by withholding an important cluster of public rights and benefits and privileges from a huge population of its citizens.
Maggie Gallagher, rebuttal.
It just seems this is like the anti-intellectualism of the intellectuals to deny that changing the basic meaning of marriage, what has always been viewed as its core component, not something external, that it involves in bringing male and female together in a special way, it's impossible to believe this could have any consequences. I don't have the time to tell you how serious the potential religious liberty implications are, except to say that serious religious liberty scholars who agree and disagree on whether it's a good idea acknowledge there are very large coming conflicts along some of the lines I set out. The difference between abortion and orientation and gay marriage is that abortion was endorsed as a personal liberty right, not as an equality right. It puts you in a completely different universe in terms of its legal impacts. On the interracial marriage question, let me just say, if I had more time, I'd respond to the infertility thing, but in the interracial marriage question, let me say this. Laws about interracial marriage were about keeping the races, two races separate, so that one race could oppress the other. That was wrong, and it was also clearly unconstitutional because racial classifications are, okay? Marriage is about bringing together the two great halves of humanity, male and female, in part so that children can know and be known by and love and be loved by their mother and father. And this is good, okay? That's the ground on which I would stand on the difference. It's an apple and oranges thing to compare those two things.
Thank you. We have 7 minutes left, and I'm going to hold my questions in the hope that some of you can get your questions in, and if you run out, I'll try mine. Yes, sir.
This is touched upon by maybe talking about licensing attorneys and positions and so forth. Now, as I recall, you directed, if I'm I don't have this right.
Is it on? Well, anyway. Human Rights Council is monitoring state by state the adoption of judicial code of conduct rules which bar judges from belonging to discriminatory organizations such as the Boy Scouts. Are you familiar with any of that?
Are you asking whether Human Rights Campaign is monitoring whether judges belong in the Boy Scouts?
The adoption of the Model Code of Judicial Conduct.
We do have a list of this of the codes of judicial conduct of state by state available online. I actually clerk for a judge who's an Eagle Scout.
Could you elaborate on that about
before becoming a judge
about judges being belonging to discriminatory organizations and that they should not belong to them?
Well, just to be clear, none of my work at HRC has related to state judges, and state judges are the overwhelming bulk of judges in this country, as you know. They're also the overwhelming, they're all of the family court judges who would pass on issues such as granting an adoption or custody rights for people who break up, et cetera. So I have done no monitoring of them unless they have been nominated to the federal bench and their practices would then be open for scrutiny in the confirmation process. But we do have online a list of all of the codes of conduct for judges. It's fairly common to have a provision in a code of judicial conduct or in the ethical rules, you know, of the bar for attorneys, something about not allowing, you know, harassment in the courtroom or unequal treatment of people in the courtroom based on their race, gender, et cetera. And some of these have begun to include sexual orientation. In fact, one of the first ones is Colorado's, interestingly.
Yes, sure.
But what I've never heard a powerful response to is how do all of your arguments not lead to the conclusion that a state cannot define marriage between two people? There are many people who would say, look, being polyamorous is a fact on the ground, and so that's something that just is, and you have to accept that. And so why can I not marry and have a successful family with three people?
That's a great question. Anybody take contracts one year? Bilateral contracts versus multilateral contracts? I won't even get to the, you know, is there a polygamous orientation versus whatever, because that's just blah. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the rights and protections that are granted to married couples, there are, for instance, duties to support. If you had three people marrying, like, who would have to support whom, or if there were competing interests of support, who would trump? Now, I'm not saying I don't support polygamy. I'm not saying a state could not come up with a way of regulating that and figuring that out and doling out the Social Security benefits accordingly, et cetera. But it's a slam dunk that there's a rational, intermediate, or even compelling reason not to allow that based on the absolute change in the ways that you would have to regulate, you know, loss of consortium claims, handing out spousal benefits for Social Security, duties to support, custody arrangements. So it's very clear that it fundamentally changes the set of obligations, benefits, and responsibilities of the parties to each other. So that is just a fundamentally different contract, and it's a fundamentally different arrangement.
Yes. Really. Is that directed to anyone? Chuck, do you want to take that?
Well, I don't think the California or the Connecticut cases are going to go to the Supreme Court. They were founded on interpretations of the state's constitutions by the state's high court. There may be federal legal theories, and I'm not suggesting I know of any, but there may be federal legal theories, and in fact I think I've seen Steve Calabresi offer some off the cuff for why some of the states that have now by judicial edict become same-sex marriage states are actually violating the federal constitution. But I don't know of any such theories that are being prepared for litigation. So I don't think these cases are ever going to get to the Supreme Court that we've been discussing here.
Sure. And there are no pending challenges to the Defense of Marriage Act, either provision of it pending in federal court, nor any challenges to state marriage laws, marriage bans.
Cheryl, I think the answer to the question of when a same-sex couple demanding a fundamental right to marriage is going to end up in the Supreme Court is when the people in the Human Rights Campaign believe they have 5 votes on the Supreme Court. So depending on who's elected president, that could change very quickly. It would not take long.
Do your opposition research. We don't litigate.
I think we have time for one more. Back
I'm sure you have influence, though, Laura, on that question.
Only when I bowl with the justices.
Thank you. This question's for Ms. Gallagher, but anybody can answer. I respect a lot of the things you said, so please don't take it to me trying to attack in any way. But do you think the state would be within its rights, or that it even should, outlaw something like divorce to protect marriage?
Would it be within its rights to outlaw divorce? I actually think of it in reverse. I know that the state is unwilling to allow me as a Roman Catholic to make a permanent marital commitment. Divorce has always been allowed in this country. The question is under what conditions. I don't think the no-fault divorce revolution was a particularly good idea, but it was done by state action and legislatures, not as a result of constitutional mandates.
Thank you all. I think we're out of time, which leaves me time to ask one of my questions, but not for Chuck to answer it since it's directed to him. In Lawrence versus Texas, Scalia, in his dissent, talked about all the terrible things that could happen. And one of the terrible things that he envisioned was that masturbation might become legal. And the question was going to be, if it weren't legal, how would you enforce the ban? But you can answer that at another time in another place. Thank you all.